Primary threat spotted.
Moving into position.
I crave the strength and certainty of steel. Cadia marks the boundary where reality and unreality meet.
Of course, we didn't expect to die out here. You know, I'm beginning to wish I'd asked for more money.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll. D20Radio.com.
Alright, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to Squad Tactica. This is a very special episode because, as you probably noticed, due to, you know, the coronavirus and stores being closed, it's really hard to get out and play Kill Team or have any legitimate conversation when you can't even go out and have a meal, let alone go out to your local game store. But this episode is going to be a lot of fun because I had the pleasure to sit down and speak with Duncan Rhodes. Yes, Duncan Rhodes from Games Workshop. And we had a great conversation talking about his history, how he got started with Games Workshop, what he's doing now, tips, tricks, using things, not using things. I don't really want to spoil it. So let's jump right in and, you know, give a big warm welcome to our special guest, Duncan Rhodes.
Hello, everybody. I'm doing very well, thank you. It's a lovely day outside, and I can sort of lean out my balcony and experience a little bit of it. So it's nice. It's good.
So for people who are listening who may not know who you are, because as we all know, there is a virus going around and people are kind of shut in. And a lot of people have actually started to pick up projects from across the board. I've seen people start doing, you know, Games Workshop stuff, Atomic Mass Games, painting their board game miniatures. And they're saying, hey, I'm finally home. I have time. I bought some paints from my shop or on Amazon or wherever. What do I do now? I figured it would be a perfect time to bring on a expert in the field. But tell the listeners a little bit more about you, where you come from, your history, and what you're doing right now.
My name's Duncan, and I've sort of, through one way or another, found myself teaching people how to paint miniatures. It wasn't exactly what I expected to do in life when, you know, I was setting out, but I've kind of found myself sort of falling into one thing after another, and it's just sort of led me here, and it's allowed me to sort of develop a passion that I have. I really enjoy helping unlock this hobby for people, and I've been very lucky to be able to do that on a bigger and bigger scale as I've gone along, really. So I used to work in Games Workshop retail many years ago, and I was working in the Derby store. I started there as a part-timer because I needed a summer job. I'd actually already got a placement at university, but I enjoyed the job so much that I decided to have a year break, which then became I didn't go. So I worked in the retail chain for a while. I had a great time. After a while, I got sort of, I left it to go and get what my parents would have called a real job. I basically worked in an office. And that was, you know, that was a good education, I think, of seeing what the outside world like a little bit. Because it's, you know, it when you're working in an environment, when you're on your passion all the time, is a very different world to when you're working in a job where, you know, basically you're there for the money, really. So that was good, I think. But I eventually came back to Games Workshop in the studio, where I got a job in what they call the hobby content providers. And this was a job I just applied for it just like any other job. But the job role was, there were four of us, and we all had like specific bits that we're providing content for, but it was essentially to fill out things. So like the back ranks and units and army books, or it might be, doing an article for White Dwarf and things. And my natural inclination was to go towards painting guides and things, you know. So I would usually be in White Dwarf doing a little army of the month, and I would do a little four-stage, you know, this is how I painted that thing during the process of it. And this was great because, you know, I've always enjoyed that part of working in the industry of teaching these things, and in retail the painting lessons were really my favorite thing. And as we got, you know, as I did more and more of these things, eventually they decided to rejuvenate the Citadel paint range, and so a new book was a part of that. And partway through the development of it, this being the sort of content that we were there for, the TV studio started the Games Workshop, and they decided to have a go at making a DVD that came along with it. So they needed somebody, and this is what I mean, I just keep sort of falling into these things. I happened to have a freer schedule and I had cleaner fingers than everyone else, so my hands didn't look so bad on camera. So the lady who did our schedules and stuff, she came over and she's like, right, this is going to happen. You all right doing it? And I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. Sure. So I got taken through to the studio and that's where I met Roger. I got introduced to him and we even got like a house on fire. We did this project, doing these, this DVD where I was basically the hands of it, and they kind of built everything around me trying to paint this thing. It was quite a learning experience because back then I was like wanting to lean in really close to what I was doing to see, you know, clearly the highlights and things I was applying. Whereas that meant my face started coming into camera. So they had to start doing things like hanging a pendulum from the ceiling so I'd know if I was going too close and stuff. It was all these like little odd things. But I just focused on painting, and then a narrator would then talk about it afterwards. But Roger wanted to develop the idea, so he kept on, you know, picking away at his boss about it, and eventually got allowed to do an experiment, which was to build a Riptide battle suit as a full guide, like imagine a replacement for an instruction booklet. And so we did that, and it's a hugely boring video, but it the concept was sound of having somebody actually like talking, and the camera angles are like, very raw at that time, but it was like, you know, it gave the impression that you were there with the person doing it. So when Roger showed it to his boss was like, that's a great idea. Yeah, let's do it. Let's hire a presenter. And so Roger comes down super excited and he's like, I think you'd be really good at this. Do you fancy doing it as your job? And I was like, oh, but I really like my current job. So it was a bit of a a bit of a crisis time, me working it out. But everyone was telling me, like, if you don't do it, someone else is going to do it, and then you'll regret it if it works out. And it's like, well, yeah, that's true. We didn't know if it would work out at the time. It was a bit scary, and back then Games Workshop was not well loved in the community, so it was, you know, are people just going to focus all of their rage upon me? So it wasn't an easy choice, but I went for it in the end. I got the job, and then after a few months of practice and training, we did the special effects paint, as we called them, with the, you know, Nylac Oxide and things like that. And then that was shortly followed by the Imperial Knight videos. And they were the first time, really, that it was shown out in the public. But people took to it really well, and it just developed from there. So it wasn't like an intentional, I'm going to be on YouTube and have a website and all this sort of stuff. It was like I liked helping people, you know, unlock the hobby. And it just sort of became a natural development to go into doing this thing and to really harness that, because it turned out I was pretty good at it. So it's been an odd career, and it's after we developed a bit, we kind of wanted to go and take it to the next level, so to speak, and that's kind of what's led me to where I am now. Now my own boss. It's quite exciting.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited to talk about your website a little bit later, but going back to kind of that history from start to finish, I remember when you started doing those videos on YouTube, and it changed the sculpture of hobby life and community, because we finally actually had not only a professional, but someone who was a part of Games Workshop. Did you see things change in the hobby side, or at least with the community aspect, once, you know, the popularity began to rise? Because like you said, you know, there was some animosity between the community and Games Workshop, but it seems to have definitely shifted, especially once the company became a lot more human when you came on to market, where it's like, oh, here's a gentleman we can associate with, and oh, he paints like I paint, and oh, wait, I can do that. He can do that. I can do that. Wow, this isn't so bad.
Yeah, I think so. At the time, I remember there was a sort of a steering away from any idea of celebrity or anything like that. So the company didn't want to have names and things. And this has all vastly changed since then. But there's a time when you can see that none of the publications or anything have any names in them. Even the novels, Black Library novels, there's no record of the author of the book. And so then I came along, and it was kind of impossible not to have my name on it, because there I am talking. And there wasn't, you know, there was quite some debate for it. Roger had to fight to get my face shown and to put my name on there and things. But I think what it did was proved that most of the animosity, I think, that people had was that the company appeared to be like a monolithic entity that didn't want to talk to them. And that wasn't necessarily the case. It was more of kind of like, or at least it seemed to me, that the company didn't want to create a sense of ego or celebrity or anything like that. Of course, the feeling of it is that, well, they don't want to talk to us, is how people are taking it. My appearance, I think, sort of forced their hand into having a name on there. But because everyone took to it so well, because like people were still talking negatively about Games Workshop, but nicely about me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which was super weird to see that. It was really, really weird. I mean, I was thanking God, you know, that people didn't hate me. I think it sort of like led people to rethink how things were being done. I think so, but I wasn't involved in the conversations where it happened. But obviously, community did come off the back of that and sort of embraced Warhammer TV, and it grew from that. So I think there was, I think it'd be naive to say there was no influence upon how things changed. But I mean, to be honest, really, I'm just glad that it did change, because all the people who work at Games Workshop are the same people. You know, they still love the community, the people who play the game. They love the game itself, the miniatures and everything, and they want to share that. Now they're able to in a very plain way, a very open way, and you can really see the results of it. So it's curious that people went from hating Games Workshop to loving Games Workshop, but the people behind the scenes were still the same people. It says a lot about how appearances, you know, how they matter, perception is a big thing, because you can have all these various intentions that you want, but if people perceive it in a different way, then that's what their truth of the matter is going to be. So, you know, in that case, you then had the perception was Games Workshop doesn't want to talk to us. The reality was not that, but it may as well be the reality that Games didn't want to talk to you, because that's how people felt about it. That's what people saw. I'm just really glad that's changed. I really am, because it leads to a whole much more positive feeling about this. And, you know, these are, it's a hobby where you're trying to escape the world and all the, you know, whatever perils there are in your life. So you don't want to be feeling negatively about the people that make it as well. So I think it's a really good change, a really, really good change. I'm really glad it's happened. I hope it can just carries on this way, really.
Mm-hmm. So I know somewhere along that line, once you were working in the media side on the front end, you began to start doing classes at conventions. Can you tell us a little bit about not only that experience, but how you, like, did you, was that a part of your original job, or was that thrust upon you, or did you volunteer to start doing those kinds of things?
Oh, no. It just suddenly happened. so I do these like live things kind of at shows like Games Day back then. So they weren't the same as the ones in America, though. I really like the way the American system is for this. It's a very intimate event where you're able to actually teach something, whereas at shows it tends to be a little bit more of an advertisement. And it's much better when the person's doing the thing with you, because you get like a real magical moment when it connects with them. But I'll talk about that in a bit. The first time I went to one of those shows was Adepticon. And as I understand at the time, it was like a big push to... it was the first time Games Workshop was, in many years, it was like the first time they were really there as a presence. So we got to do, I was told, it was, I don't know, a few weeks before we went, I was doing three seminars. It might have been four, actually. But I was told, they're going to be so many hours, what do you want to paint? I went, could we do something that's not out yet? That would be pretty cool. And they went, ooh, that's a good idea. What would you like to do? So we got to do the Caradron. So we got to take along a bunch of Caradron Arcanauts. And they were just a reveal at the event. So it was then super cool in the seminar to go, by the way, here's one of the models. It's yours. And Roger was there too, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. So that he would be going and handing them out. And I'd be like, oh, check them out. It's a Caradron Arcanaut. Yeah. However, they're not out yet. So you're going to have to give them back at the end of the session. And everyone go, oh. I'm like, oh, I'm kidding with you. Hey! It was fun being, because like early on with the videos, there was a very structured, like I was trained to do the presentation and things. And the style at the time was going to be very just formal, like casual, chatty, but still to the point about the thing. And those live events were something that caused a bit of a catalyst to show personality, I think, because I was able to be like, because I like to be quite jokey and jovial about these sorts of things. And it was nice to be like that. And I think I surprised people with that sort of thing. And going forward at more of these things, I'd have fun like being very one-to-one with somebody if they were struggling on a thing. Like if I was teaching them a technique, I don't know, edge highlighting, for example, and they're doing it and they're struggling with it. And I'd be like, you know, is anyone find this difficult? Someone might put their hand up. Okay, let's have a look. And they're watching what they're doing, correcting them. I'd like have fun by going, by the way, am I putting you off? As I'm like, my face is right next to their hands. They'd be like, yeah, oh, don't worry, it's fine, it's fine. but the next thing that we did were quite different. It was I suddenly the format suddenly changed in that there were a lot more of them, and the subjects were decided for me. So there was a bit of a back and forth after that as to working out the best way of doing these things. I believe the way they work now is that there's a bit of a recipe that the event picks from, as I understand it. But it was definitely an organic growth progress. But it wasn't what I signed up to do. It wasn't like, you know, I wanted to be making videos, really. But the best bit about it was connecting with people on a personal level. That was really cool because, like I was saying, when I'm there with one person teaching them a thing, like the last one I went to, Nova last year, there were some classes on doing skin tones. And it was one of the, I think it was the last one of day two. And I was pretty tired at that point for that because it was long marathon sessions these days. And I don't think I gave it the best, like when I was explaining these things. So I completely overnight rethought what I was doing for the class. And so the next day when we did the next one, I approached it in a completely fresh, different manner. And actually it turned out it wasn't so much about painting skin. It was more about technique of layering and doing soft highlights on things. And I started like painting diagrams on my palette on this overhead projector so people could see what I was explaining and things and then going around one at a time. And you'd see people would start painting it. And then I'd sort of like correct them and get them to do it. And I'd watch what they were doing and explain and like, keep doing this, keep going. Don't go back to where they go. There you go. Like, okay, so it looks a bit soft. Now that second coat. All right. So they focus a bit more like that. And then they'd get it. And they'd suddenly stop and look at their model and then look at mine, then look at theirs. And I'd be like, yours looks the same as mine, doesn't it? And they're like, yeah, there you go. That's what I mean by two thin coats. And the person would be like, oh my God, I've done it. So those experiences, again, that one-to-one sort of connection where the person would then get the result that they dreamed of getting. That was such a wonderful feeling to be able to do that. So those moments were easily the best of those shows abroad. I didn't see much of the show itself of these things because I was always doing these classes. But it was an exciting experience. And I think it's something that shows that format. They take a lot of work to set up, but they are really good. So I do think in UK conventions, there's definitely room for doing stuff like that in the future. I think, the way you guys over in America do these shows, I mean, you do them big. there's nothing in the UK quite like how things like Adepticon are. I do wonder in 5 years' time, maybe, I do wonder if the UK event circuit is going to match the American one a little bit more. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Okay. So now I definitely want to transition into what you're doing now. So you have your own website, you're doing your own business, you're your own boss. Mm. What exactly is that looking like for, you know, you, like, what did you, I guess the best question, the way to ask it is, what were you, hoping to achieve by starting this own company and your own online presence?
Well, it's quite a bit to unpack, I think. to start with, my career path has always led me after so many years up to like the next stage of showing things on a bigger level. And I suppose I kind of wanted to do something like that because I've been into all sorts of different war games beyond Warhammer for 15 or 20 years, I suppose. And I found it curious when talking to people at those shows, as we were talking about earlier, how people are surprised that actually I've got other interests in the wargaming world. Like I really like my Napoleonics, for example. It leads to some really interesting conversations that would then get the person to look at the gaming hobby in a slightly different way. So it's always been at the back of my mind, what would it be like to do painting tutorials on other things, how people respond to them? If I did a British Napoleonic soldier, would that lead people to then having a go at that hobby? Because we found with the Warhammer things, what we were doing there was a great entryway into that sort of thing. So we're kind of wondering, would that happen with other stuff too? So on a personal interest level, there was that. And it kind of meant that it was like that step up to the next level where I'd rather than just be focusing on Games Workshop product, I could now move on to a whole host of different subjects and use different materials and different equipment and show things in the way that we do, which people say they find accessible. So it's not like, I mean, I've always been aware that what we do isn't really like the high end kind of, you know, really advanced competition sort of painting, but it is very accessible and it gets people very excited and confident. And so it's cool to sort of shift that up to the next level. At the same time, it was always a bit of a dream for Roger in particular, but me sort of like, on the side, I don't think it'll happen. But for Roger, he's always wanted to have his own business. It's a thing he's always dreamed about. The topic will come up every now and then, but we started thinking to ourselves, you know, could we sort of like cross over with these things? Could we, we've been here quite a while now, we've done quite a lot. What were the next stage? Well, maybe we could do this independently. Maybe it could go as our own thing. And we sort of like talked more and more about it. And eventually we decided that, you know, we're not getting any younger. it's, if we're going to do it, we've got to do it. Otherwise, it's going to be like, you know, when I applied for the job in the first place, I could have not done it and stayed safe and comfortable, but then somebody else would have gone and done it and done all these things. So, you know, if we don't try it, then when are we going to try it? So, yeah, we decided to have a crack of it. So, yeah, left Games Workshop, which was a scary, scary moment, and then went out and bought some very expensive cameras and worked out how to do a studio and founded a business and everything. So it means now that we are our own bosses, and it's really exciting. I mean, it's the kind of luxury I think that I suppose a lot of people won't really get the chance to do something on their own. But if you're able to, if you're able to have a go at running your own business and thing, I definitely recommend it, because it's suddenly it's your passion to do this thing. I mean, you have to do it because you've got to make money, because you've got to, you're like, no one else is responsible for making paying the bills other than you. But you're able to do it in your way, in a way that you believe in a way that you want to. Because you often get people talking about how, you know, when they go to work, it doesn't feel like work. But I mean, it does at times feel like work, but it's such a personal thing, such a personal part of your life then. And it's just fantastic to be completely on your own time schedule, to do things as you want to do, to produce what you want to do, and to have that direct connection with what people want then. Because it means now on this site, we can do anything we want with any subject, with any materials, for any skill level, and we can do it at any time. And it being only the two of us, there's no red tape for us to go through. There's no approval process. There's no scheduling in amongst product releases or anything like that. We can just decide, well, lots of people are asking about the Horus Heresy. Why don't we go and do all 18 Legions? All right, why not? It doesn't take that long to film each one. Yeah, I mean, it's a possibility. Why don't we go and do something like that? Why don't we cover, you know, every faction with a core model? Why don't we do, the current going plan is to do a big model every month, which means 12 big centerpiece things every year. It's so exciting at the moment. The world really is our oyster. The downside, of course, is that we have to charge to be able to do it. As we did our research about, you know, how can you make a living out of this sort of thing? And so, of course, there's the YouTuber idea of, you know, be on YouTube and make money through adverts. But looking into that, if you monetize your videos, you don't actually make very much money at all. You have to get millions of views to be able to live on that. It's a really steep curve going from like making very little to making an obscene amount. And with the kind of with the niche market that this is, we're just not going to get to those sort of numbers. So, okay, so we can't just survive by just having YouTube adverts. So what are the other options? Well, there's Patreon. Okay, we looked at Patreon. It's a very bloggish kind of appearance on things. And our idea was to make an archive where it's easy to navigate this thing and find what you want and have an internal consistency, so that, you know, if you learn the basics with us, you can then apply those techniques to every video that we show and go through them as a little case project. So Patreon didn't really work out as the ideal platform for it, which left making our own website, which was like, ooh, okay, got to learn to make a website now. So off we went to do it. So again, it was another challenge, a completely new area that we had no experience in, and we learned how to do it, and it worked, thank God. So it's been really exciting. It's been really exciting. The first half of this year has just been an absolute whirlwind, but it's been so much fun. I've enjoyed every minute of it. Yeah, it's great. It's really great. Thank God it worked. But yeah, we came with the subscription format model, where we did our maths, we did our research and stuff. We figured about pricing it as low as possible. For what we thought we'd get as membership, because ideally we want as many people to be able to see it as possible. We knew we'd have a YouTube channel too, where we put some free content on there. So, you know, if you don't want to pay, you can still see what we do. That's perfectly cool. And yeah, we then crossed our fingers and hoped that people would sign up. And thank God they did. Launch day was a very stressful day, let me tell you. Like, oh God, we've been planning.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, this has been a plan for so long, and on that day everything was on the line. Like, now we find out if people actually care enough to, you know, put money down to support us on this, and they did, thank God. So we're making, you know, we're doing all right now. We think we're on a good course to be nice and stable and to be able to pay our bills and to be able to, provide for our families, basically. So it's, thank God.
That's good. That's good. Now, a quick question about the website, duncanroads.com.
Yes.
For those people who might be on the fence because there's a lot of content on YouTube already, and they say, oh, hey, you know, it's free. Why would I pay? What exactly is the your website and your team offering differently for the paying members that you can't get if you're just, you know, scrubbing through YouTube and finding people who paint?
I think the so I could say the initial thing that you don't get is Roger. It's not so like for all the years people have talked about is, you know, me doing these things, and even the website's based off of my name for it because people think of me when they think of these videos. But it's actually Roger's the guy who put them together, and he trained me to present them, and he has the ideas about how to operate the thing. And the two of us have been working together closely on these for 8 years now. That's a crazy thought. But anyway, so we're very efficient at what we do. We're very quick at what we do, which means we can hit a very high consistent standard. And that's in terms of the tuition, the camera work, the narrative of the video, the length of the video, the painting standard in there, the what we'd call product awareness as to what equipment we're using based upon the target for that video. These are all things that we think about in a professional manner because we have been doing that since day one. So that's not changed with us. We don't do things based upon a whim of how we would like it. So it's not like I'm going to teach you how to paint Space Marines like this because I like it. It's like, this is how you get Space Marines that look like the ones that you're used to seeing in all the artwork and all the boxes and things. This is how you paint. It's not the official way of Games Workshop anymore. It's like it is a, like, we're not associated with them, it is a separate thing. But the same thing's true for, like, if you see really nice artwork of Romans and stuff and you want to be able to paint them like that, our objective will be to show you how to paint a model like that as nicely as possible with minimal paints and the easiest learning curve that we can think of. So everything's focused and based around that. So that's one thing that I think is a very key point to our success and has been our success over the years. Also, Roger very much is a very important part of this thing because he's extremely skilled at putting together these videos in a clear and concise way. He's very good at basically listening to what I'm saying, making sure it makes sense, and stopping me if I say something that doesn't make sense. So he's a good filter on these things. He asks questions from the perspective of someone who's not as into the hobby as I am. So through that filter, we were able to make things nice and clear. He is very good at his camera work. So he is able to get very crisp shots and has a detailed understanding as to how all the filmography of it works. So he's trained me to put things in such a way that it gives him options in the shot to make an interesting viewing experience. He's able to get the shot now in the close-up, the one that sort of goes over my shoulder, at a very close, very crisp way. So he's able to get in closer than other ones that you see on YouTube and things. So I think the difference is that you're painting for the professional standard that he brings to things. Not to belittle like what you have out on YouTube there, but like he's got a very specific sphere that he's very, very good at, and he brings that into the rest of the stuff of what I then provide. So you get that really high end quality stuff, and because we're able to provide this stuff very quickly, it means you get multiple videos every week. So unless we're doing something particularly big, which is what we've been doing this week, actually, it's taken us a whole week to do the one model, but it means that every week you're going to be getting 2 to 3 videos, and then once a month you'll have 1 week where you get one video, but it'll be a big centerpiece thing. Something that's taken us numerous hours to put together and is very detailed and has done a lot of work to prepare it beforehand. So I think those are the main features of it. As we go forward, we're going to be expanding our offering. So to begin with, obviously people know me for doing videos where it's a single miniature, we take it from start to finish. So we're going to do a whole host of those things, but we're starting to introduce technique videos that are on specific things that I do that teach that ability. So the goal of them is to sort of introduce practice sessions of that things to do and models that we recommend that you do these things on. But that way you get sort of like a self-contained language almost, which you can then look at the miniatures we painted. And the ultimate goal being that you're then able to go and paint one of these models that looks the same as the one I've done. And what's more, you're then able to adapt those techniques to another model. So if you painted if you copied our British Napoleonic infantry guy, the goal will be then you're able to take the skills that you learn there and be able to paint a Prussian soldier or a Brunswick soldier or whatever. That's the goal. That's the overall driving narrative of this sort of thing, of what we want to do. So yeah, we're completely committed to that. So if you do support us, if you do pay for it, you have access to all that sort of thing. There's no tiers or anything like that, no special, you know, extra levels of it or anything like that. It's just straight up, you're willing to support us, you get access to everything. And going forward, there's going to be a lot of videos on that site, right? A lot, because we're producing a lot of them very fast. So yeah, I think that's what makes us different, I think.
Okay, super cool. I'm excited to dive into that very soon myself. But let's talk a little bit more about the technical aspect of painting. And the first question I have that I want to focus on is for those who are newer painters who are just getting started, or some of us who used to paint, we got busy and now we're coming back because we have so much time available. Yeah. What are some of your tips to improve your painting skill? Like, you know, we understand the fundamental of, you know, water down your paints and, you know, use brush strokes and, you know, don't just scribble, but trying to improve on, you know, very, very basic fundamentals. What can people do so that, you know, they get, you know, either a nice clean line or, you know, they have a nice clean color palette on their model. And so it's not kind of splotchy, because, you know, we see that happen with newer painters, or, you know, just basic brush handling tips, because they're trying to figure out, you know, do I use my left hand, my right hand, you know, do I use two fingers, one finger, thumb, pointer, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a good few core things to learn that are useful for everybody. The brush control is a huge thing. And it's, I mean, I suppose when you first look, like, everyone's got to go out painting something, but when you're doing this sort of detail work, it is like a precise motion for it. The palette use is huge for that. The palette allows you to test what the paint's going to do on the miniature, which is why it's so important. So a few things that I'd recommend people doing and getting used to that is, when you're actually diluting the paint with water on your palette, you put your dollop of paint on there, add the water to the side of it, and then gradually introduce pigment into it, because this allows you to kind of go back and forth to get a feel for it. And then just try practicing painting lines on your palette to see how long you can go just doing little lines. Because if you're able to get to a point where the paint flows smoothly correctly, you should, in theory, be able to just keep on doing these lines for a long, 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 long time. If you got it like that, that's the consistency of what you're aiming for. And once you get that feeling, you're then able to apply that to all the different paints that are out there, because each one of them you want to sort of bring to that point. So that's the first thing I'd recommend. Second thing is, sitting comfortably, embracing hands correctly is a big thing. Like, shaky hand syndrome is a big deal, but you can really mitigate a lot of that by sort of bracing your hands together. And if you watch any of the videos that I've done for Games Workshop and the Neuro Academy ones, you'll notice that whenever I'm painting something, my hands are actually always touching each other when I'm actually doing the painting on the close-up. And it could be as simple as, so my left hand's actually holding the model, usually on one of Citadel's painting handles, which are great, by the way. I definitely recommend people get one of those if you're just starting out. Your right hand wants to be touching your left hand, because you steady yourself on that, which allows you to get those smoother lines and gives you more precise control over getting to all the details and things. So you'll notice that often, like, my wrists will be together, but sometimes it even goes to just like my little finger on my right hand will just be touching my thumb on my left hand as I'm moving around on things. And it is just that anchoring point helping keep myself steady. So that's the thing to watch for. And those videos, if you just watch the little subtleties as to what I'm doing, that's usually more important than the actual color I'm using. After that, practice just being neat, blocking in base colors. Just Citadel base paints are great for this sort of thing. I mean, there's loads of other manufacturers out there, but the base paints are designed specifically for it. They have really good coverage of things. So just having a go at painting models with just those paints, just blocking in areas of colors like you're just coloring in a picture, that's a great thing to do. And then when you introduce washes and shades to it to give it depth and just run all over it, that just, like, you'll notice immediately if it's the first time doing that, it just takes things to the next level. After that, the third thing to learn would be layering, which is like base coating, but it's a little bit more precise. And then if you're going to move on to highlights, you'll see that's what really makes the miniature pop. But those four stages are kind of like the most miniatures I paint follow those four general stages. And the first two of those are really important ones to kind of get used to. And you can paint whole armies just for those first two stages if you want to. But if you focus on those just as you're getting used to things, with that brush control I was talking about and the paint diluted correctly, it's just a matter of using those things to get nice, neat finishes on things. And then if you want to expand upon that, you can do. So those are the key things I'd go for to begin with. So, yeah. So to help out with that, having a variety of brush sizes is a good idea. I generally use ones from Army Painter and Citadel because I'm comfortable with those ones, but there's, like, getting loads and loads of ones out there. If you're going to use Citadel ones, there's a few I just recommend that you pick up if you're just getting started. The first would be a medium base brush, then it would be a medium shade brush, and then a medium layer brush. those three are incredibly useful, and you can paint most things with just those three. And then after that, expanding around that to increase your collection is a good idea. But those three are great starting brushes.
Okay. So the other thing you're well known for is the tooth and coats comment.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit for the listeners? Like, why tooth and coats? What is the utility and necessarily like, or was that more of like a branding thing from Games Workshop?
Oh, no. It's just what you do, which is the funny thing about it sort of following me around as a little meme and stuff. I don't mind it at all. I find it quite charming. But I'm glad that it's that's following me around, because it's actual genuine advice as to what you do. And the only fear, I suppose, is that people think it's a joke. But it is actually, it's 101 knowledge, this sort of stuff, when you paint these things. So what it is that imagine if you're painting a wall, for example, with some emulsion paint or something like that. If you gunk on loads of paint, you get brush marks and lumps on it. Whereas if you do it thinly, so you don't get those going on, it's still a bit transparent. So you do a second coat and then you get a nice even finish on it. If you think of it like putting layers of, crepe paper, like sort of that transparent coloured paper that you get.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of it like putting layers of that on, the more layers of that you get, the more solid the colour becomes. If you put on one thick lump of it, the fluid dynamic of the thing will just mean that you get a lumpy finish to things. And no one explained this to me when I was starting out, which is why my first model just looks so horribly lumpy all over the place. But the weird thing about it was when because it's just what you do, right? I was taught this after a number of years. Basically, somebody this is what you're doing wrong. Oh, and then it clicks, and okay, there we go. But it's not common knowledge. It's not obvious at first. And in the painting guides that Citadel was doing, or Games Workshop was doing, it would be like base coat with this color, and base coat with this, and this, and this, this, and stage one. Then in stage two, it would be then wash it with this, this, this. Stage three would be then highlight like this. None of it explained these things that you do. So in the videos, it became suddenly the first Games Workshop-y kind of thing that was showing these things in such a big way. So the tooth and coats thing, whilst it had been common knowledge in the industry for since forever, I was the first person saying it in such a public level, which meant that it stuck. but then when people actually try it, because people would laugh at it. I remember in the early days, people thought I was trying to get them to waste their paint. So I know you don't do that. Why would bother? No, it's just trying to get, because again, that cynical Games Workshop attitude was there at the time. But when you actually do it and you see the difference, it's so self-evident that that's what you have to do, that it's like, oh, okay, there you go. And so I think what happened is people then felt good about that and then sort of latched that feeling onto me telling them these things. And it became sort of a feel-good internal joke in the internet at large. I've noticed people timestamp in the videos that we put on YouTube now, because we open the comments up now. People timestamp when I say tooth and coats. What? Okay. Is this a game that people are doing? Is there some forum somewhere where they're all slighting who can find the most in the most recent video or something? But I think it's really fun. It's a really charming thing. It's it represents for me a huge relief of back in those early days when I thought people would hate me, that people have seen that I just want to help people paint their toys and have kind of embraced that. So it's quite a warm, fuzzy feeling that I get from it. it's a strange thing. I don't feel like I say it all that often, to be honest with you. I think normally what I say is apply a second thin coat once the first one's dry. I think that's what I normally say. I think other people have abbreviated that to two thin coats. But people like shout it out like across car parks and stuff. And one of the folks who came in to go for one of my painting classes made a shirt that had hashtag tooth in coats on it, and I still got it. I wear it sometimes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it's a very charming, nice thing. But for anyone starting out, it is actually, don't underestimate it. It's light and funny, how it follows me around. But when it comes to actually painting your models, it isn't a jokey thing. It is it's what you do. It's very basic 101 knowledge. And I guarantee you, if you've been putting on the paint and it goes all lumpy and stuff, you try applying it as two thin coats. Hey, someone will timestamp that. You try applying it like that, it'll look much better. Trust me, it'll look much better. You're not wasting your paint. You're getting a better result, and then it's worth it.
So let's talk a little bit about the tools that you recommend and the tools you don't recommend, because right now it's very easy to come into the hobby, and you can see on Facebook or a website or even some of these forums and threads, hey, you know, there's, you know, lighting, there's a wet palette, there's a cleaning utility piece, there's all these brushes, there's all these paints, there's paint mixers, there's, you know, it's a lot of information to parse, especially for someone who just started and said, oh, I bought this model from whatever game and I have a brush and a base coat. What do you recommend actually buying? And then what do you think, hey, you may not need this, or you can, you know, get this later in your painting career, but it's not something you like need. Kind of like you were saying, those medium-sized brushes will really get the job done from Games Workshop to get started. You know, what other things do you use and recommend for people who are, you know, getting their feet wet?
Okay. Well, the subtleties of it will change based upon what it is exactly you want to paint, of course, because different games and different things are made from different materials, so there are some subtleties to that. But I'll come back to that sort of thing in a bit. If you're wanting to paint a model, the core things you're going to need are, first of all, a primer. I definitely recommend a spray primer rather than painting it by hand. The reason being, it's much faster, because undercoating by hand is really boring. Like, I mean, you want to paint all that cool detail on your model, but sorry, first of all, you got to paint it all one flat color. It just takes ages and it's a pain, and you don't want to obscure detail by putting on too thickly, but then you feel like you've got to put on enough to make it cover everywhere. So it's just not a pleasant experience. And if you're new into it and you want to enjoy painting your models, it'll put you off, believe you me. So get a spray primer. I recommend a medium gray for it. That's what I use almost all the time. The one I usually use is Mechanica Standard Gray from Games Workshop. It's a really, really nice medium gray. And the alternatively, there's Uniform Gray from the Army Painter, which is a little bit lighter, but it's very similar. Another option is Zandri Dust from Games Workshop. That's more of a beige. But the reason why I recommend these ones is because they're nice neutral mid-tones, which means that just about any paint you pick up will apply well over the top of it, some better than others. Yellows are notorious for poor coverage, but even some yellows apply very well over that. But it means that if you're painting, say you're going to paint Star Wars Legion, for example, and you want to paint a Stormtrooper, even though the armor's white, the gray undercoat is still a good starting point for getting that white over. It means white sprays and things, but the gray will still take to the initial base coat that you want to get. You can paint your Rebels starting from that gray undercoat as well. You could paint your AT-ST like that. Your speeder bikes can start from that. Vader, Luke, all of them can start from this gray primer. Whereas if you go for something like a white one, it's great for speeding up your Stormtroopers, but it's not so hot for everything else. Same for if you're painting any Warhammer stuff, you both your Death Guard and Ultramarines and your core set for 40K, that can be, you know, starting from gray. So this is that's the reason why I recommend that and what I tend to use it the most, which incidentally reminds me, in our videos, we try to minimize paint use, which is why we start from gray usually. But that's the first thing. Then if you're starting fresh, get a bunch of stronger pigment base coat colors to block in all the details, and then pick a single wash to shade them all and bring them all together. So there's a number of Citadel sets of paints. I believe there's one where it's all base paints, but the base paints are important because they've got stronger pigment in them, which means they cover other colors better. So it's the other ones tend to be weaker, which is good for particular techniques, but it means you've got to apply more coats of it to get the color to be consistent over an area. So the base paints are good ones to have. You want to get like a nice little selection of the ones focused on your army. I wouldn't worry about getting all the primary colors and secondary colors and then going on there. I'd go for, if you're painting like an Ultramarine, look at what the Ultramarine base colors are and then just pick those ones out. Then go for a wash over the top of them. And if you want a general purpose one, a brown one is great. From Citadel, Agrax Earthshade is amazing. From the Army Painter, Strong Tone. Yeah, Strong Tone is amazing as well. That's a very similar color. They behave slightly differently. Strong Tone's a little bit thicker. It doesn't run quite so much. There's pros and cons to that. But those are great as well for just general purpose. Black is an alternative if you want a cleaner finish to things, but brown can do just about anything. So those are the core paints I'd recommend going for. Ideally, that would bring you, for most miniatures, 10 paints or less doing that. And then after that, you can then start looking at highlighting the thing once you've got those colors blocked in and everything. For brushes, those three I mentioned are great ones: a medium base from Citadel, a medium layer from Citadel, and a medium shade from Citadel. Those three are brilliant. The large base from Citadel is also very good. Army Painter's got a great little brush set where you get like a nice variety of all brushes. So that's a good one to pick up if you want a nice variety of brushes to begin with. Their Regiment brush is very good. That's a little bit larger than Games Workshop's medium layer brush, but it holds a good point. So if you get the dexterity of the brush control correctly, you can use that for finer detail too. Army Painter also do a great range of really fine brushes, the detail brush, the character brush, things like that. When you're starting out, that's not quite so important, but going forward, you'll probably want to get one of those at some point. When it comes to the actual tools of using your paint, for a palette, all you need is an old plate. That'll do just fine. It's best to have one that's white, I think, because then you can judge the color and the thin, the consistency of it easiest, because you can see through it the white, so you know how thin the paint is. A tile is great as well. At home, I've got a dinner plate that I bought for £1. That's what I use for my own palette, and I have been using it for years and years. I once actually managed to clean it and get all the paint from it, and I've got a plate of paint now. but a tile is equally good, and you can go to a hardware store, and you can usually get sampler tiles around the kitchen area, and these will cost you like next to nothing, and it's perfect. It's nice and flat. It's got loads of space for doing stuff on there. And for water, all you need is a jar or something. That'll be just fine. For a wet palette, loads of people swear by them, and they are great. They're not necessary. They are very useful if you're using more advanced techniques. The reason being, they basically stop your paint from drying out really fast. Using a good wet palette, you can keep your paint wet for a long, long, long time. It means that if you're painting something blue and you go through a bunch of models, I want to stop, close up the palette. When you come back to it, the paint will still be usable. That's the main advantage of it for most of the time. Because it stays wet, it's really good if you're going to be mixing colors a lot. So if you do intend to do lots of mixing, a wet palette's a useful investment just because the mix that you then make will last for a long time without drying out straight away, and then you've got to mix it again and again and again. But ideally, you don't want to be mixing paints if you can avoid it when you're starting out, which is why you don't necessarily need a wet palette. If you do want to go for one, though, the one I use is from the Army Painter. It's pretty cool. It's got a little selection of like little holder for brushes in there. So if you want to go for one, that's one that I use. But there's loads and loads out there, and it's actually quite possible to make your own pretty easily. There's videos on YouTube showing how to do that. But don't feel like you have to have one. I often see people swearing by them and sort of perhaps unwittingly trying to pressure people into using one of them. You don't have to have one, but they are a cool extra, is what I'd say about that. What else? When it comes to actually the assembly of the models and things, if you're doing board games and stuff, the miniatures are probably going to be soft plastic. These will have mold lines on them, which a file, if you try and use a file to remove them, it will kind of burr the plastic and make a mess of things. So the mold line, by the way, it's just inevitable of plastic molding. It's just like a little fine line you'll have around the part where the two halves of the mold came together. If you're going to remove it on a soft plastic miniature, you'll need a sharp knife to do it. A little craft knife will do the job. And you just basically gently follow it around the miniature. And if you find those models are bent in a weird shape, all you have to do is heat them up and they'll bend into the position that you want. So just put them in some, like boil the kettle, pop them in the water, bring them out with some tweezers. They'll bend to what position you want. So if you're coming from a board game background, that's just something worth bearing in mind before you prime your models. From a regular wargaming side of things, plastic glue for plastic miniatures is brilliant. Super glue can do everything. There's loads of companies that sell these things. The super glue from the Army Painter is really nice large bottle for that. You get some clippers so you can cut the things out. Citadel ones are cool, but there's loads and loads of manufacturers out there. The core things I'd say is some clippers and a knife. I think they're the two most important tools when it comes to preparing your models, and then you at least will need some super glue to put them together. So I think those are kind of the core things that I'd recommend to somebody when they're starting.
Okay. So
yeah. You see how the colours and things will vary depending on what exactly they want to do. But there's actually, if you're doing a Games Workshop thing, there's a Citadel colour app which actually has loads of models in there. And they call it the Battle Ready method. It's like a classic method. And in there, it will show all these core models and it will show what colours are recommended to base coat those and shade those with. So if you're not sure what colours to go for, that's a really useful app if you're doing Warhammer stuff.
So the next thing I want to query you on is the argument of brushes. There's the constant discussion about, name brand, Citadel, Army Painter, Games and Gears, blah, 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 blah. Or, I buy mine at Walmart, Hobby Lobby. They're just, brushes I bought. What is your take on that? Also, the types of hairs, for those who may not know, that you've got horse hair, badger hair, synthetic brush. And there's constantly this discussion amongst people in the community, you know, synthetics are better, horse hair is better, Kalinske is better, you got it, but you have to buy Kalinske Games Workshop. No, you buy synthetic army paint. Like, you know, there's all these names and terms mm-hmm. being thrown around, but does it really matter?
I've found actually there's more of a character on an individual brush than people give them credit for, I think. I tend to find that I'll find a brush, I'll just sort of find my way to one that just performs really well for me, just holds its point, holds a good amount of paint for what I want and things. And I just end up using it until it's about had it, you know, and it's about destroyed, at which point I'll sort of like merge over to find another one. So I wouldn't say there's any one particular brand I stick to. Obviously, I've used mostly Citadel over the years because I've worked for Games Workshop. But I know that the brushes that high-end painters often swear by are Winsor Newton Series 7 ones. And the Games Workshop Artificer brushes are the same sort of thing. Basically, they're sable hair, which, as I understand from the high-end painters of what they like, those are the best ones you can get. At least that's what they generally have told me. I found that they're good, but they still can be prone to getting a bad brush every now and then that doesn't hold its tip very well. So I don't think you have to go for these high-end brushes. I don't think they make that big a difference. I think a skilled painter can still paint something very, very nicely, no matter what sort of brush he's got, so long as the brush is able to hold the point, I think is the key thing. So the regular Games Workshop brushes, I think, are absolutely fine. If you're wanting to do something really fancy, it's a nice idea to have one of those sable brushes for really fine detail, like freehanding and things like that. At which point, yeah, I'd recommend a Series 7 or go for... I believe there's one from Army Painter, and there's the Artificer brushes from Games Workshop, which are good for that sort of thing. Now, when it comes to synthetic brushes, they will inevitably, over time, start to curl because it's just part of their character. Games Workshop's normal brushes, by the way, are horsehair, I believe. And they work very nicely. But with this curling with synthetic brushes, you got to understand that when you use them, they do have a bit of a shelf life because of that. Eventually, they all fray so much that it's very difficult to get any use out of them other than very rough application of like an initial color or putting on some textured paint onto, say, for example, tank tracks or something like that. So they're useful to keep around for that sort of thing. But as you get them, like say if you get one of these medium base brushes, you'll find when you first get it, it goes to a point. It's like a chisel point. So that's cool. After a number of sessions, you'll notice it'll start to curl. Over time, that curl will get more and more pronounced. So it's not the end of the world, but it means that if you're still using it for precision stuff, it'll get difficult. But for doing the initial block in colors, if you're angling the bristles correctly, you can easily get to what you want. And what they are good for is covering large areas fast because they're very robust for that sort of thing. So I always keep one of these medium base brushes for, say, for example, the last thing I was painting was a French chasseur, light cavalryman. And I used it to roughly block in the color of the horse, the brown for that. Then on the saddle cloth is like the sort of sheepskin, like sort of woolly kind of white pattern. So I just use it to block that in. And it's great for doing those sort of medium to large areas really fast. And then, okay, it's done its job. It's nice and robust, nice and quick. Put it to one side, get a more focused brush for doing the finer detail like the reins and stuff like that. So I'd say synthetic brushes are good for that sort of thing, but don't be surprised when they start to curl. For that reason, though, I don't think they're ideal for fine detail, but that's just my opinion on it, really.
So as we begin to slowly wrap up this interview, and once again, thank you so much for your time. I believe a lot of people hearing this are going to start to kind of have these things pop. Like when you said your hands are touching when you paint, I was like, oh my goodness, I never, and I've watched a lot of your videos, I never saw that. I'm going to have to see if I do that naturally, because I'm like, oh man, that's great. That's a great piece of information for studying. Let's talk about the inverse. So we've been talking about all the good stuff, all the great stuff. What are some things you should not do while you're painting?
Oh, okay. So the first thing I think would relate a bit to the equipment that you were talking about. Don't feel like you've got to drop a small fortune on getting the absolute best stuff, especially when you're starting out. That's just not the case. There's a whole host of brands out there and they all, you know, offer good stuff. So don't feel like you've got to throw hundreds and hundreds of pounds to begin with at this sort of stuff. So things to watch out for, I think, let's see. So when you're using your brush, be careful not to dunk it into tons of paint. So for the anatomy of the brush, you've got like this metal collar where the bristles come out of. It's called the ferrule. If you get paint into where the bristles go into the ferrule, what happens is it dries there and it starts to force the bristles apart. So what that does is massively reduce the lifespan of your brush, because you'll lose the point in it just about straight away. So you got to get into the habit of not doing that with your brush, but instead just using it more towards the tip of it to get your paint onto your palette. And then when you're diluting it with water, allowing that to inhabit the body of the brush, but not go all the way up to the ferrule. So it's like sort of like a bit of precise control on that to get the hang off. Just don't, you know, don't dunk it all the way in. Second thing I would think too is kind of very basic, I suppose, but always make sure things are dry before you do the next bit, because you can end up wrecking stuff. But also at the same time, there's a subtlety to that when it comes to applying things like washers and further contrast paints from Citadel, of course. When you put those on, they get to a certain point where they're starting to set, at which point they're kind of like, if you've ever used a load of PVA glue, you ever notice how you get like a skin forming on the top of it, but it's still wet beneath? It's that kind of thing. So if you go back to the paint when it's doing that, what you do is you tear the surface and you get a rough appearance to it then. So you've got to allow it to set, even if there's like an error on it, before you go back to fix it up. Because if you go back too soon, you'll cause a really rough finish to things. So there's that. I think a thing to watch out for is not to let yourself get disheartened as well, because everybody started somewhere. I think it's very easy. I mean, I didn't really think about it much, to be honest to you, until more recently. I realized one time I was doing a gaming event with a friend of mine, and he was embarrassed of his models next to mine, which I found really, really like shocking, because I never really thought of it like people comparing themselves to me. But you basically shouldn't do that. Like, every person's like their own entity and what they're doing and their own standard and what they're happy with. So you shouldn't let yourself be put off by looking at all these ones, these incredible things you can see online, and thinking there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. If you want to do that, you can do it. You just got to put the work in to learn how to do it. It just takes time and practice, like anything really. If you want to play the guitar, you can do it as long as you put the time into learning it. So don't be discouraged. Just concentrate on these beginning steps, you know, the initial stages of neatness and getting the hang of using the brush correctly and blocking in the base colors and then seeing how shades and washes behave. Once you've got that, you can then start moving forward, and you'll surprise yourself with what you can achieve with these basic things and this understanding as you start to expand to extra techniques. Don't let people put you off. Don't get upset if people say something nasty about your paintwork if you post it online. I think that's an underrated but important thing to get. I'd never really thought about it up until, you know, I realized people comparing themselves to me in that way, which was very strange. But yeah, those are some people I'd be aware of. Also, I suppose for wargaming in general, I think a thing that is misunderstood is that, so in Games Workshop, the term would be the hobby, right? Your hobby. What is your hobby? And everyone's hobby is a bit different when it comes to wargaming. Everyone has different focuses on different things. Like me, for example, I really enjoy my painting, but I like army painting, like tabletop standard painting is what I do. I'm not interested in competition painting, and I'm not interested in tournament gaming. I like just painting my models to a point I'm happy with, and then just having fun with them in a casual game. You always got to remember that people will always be different and be looking for different things. So if you're new to it and you paint your army and you have your first game and you get thrashed by somebody who's very, very good at the game, again, don't be disheartened. It's just a bit of a mismatch. You just need to find an opponent that's more attuned to the kind of game that you want as well.
All right, so last question. This is going to be a fun one. Do you have any funny stories from all the travels and, you know, conventions and events that you've been to? Do you have a funny story to share with the audience? Because, you know, you were saying people will yell tooth and coats at you at these things. That's pretty funny.
So my girlfriend's Polish, right? And we were in her hometown, this city called Wroclaw, which is like the third city in Poland. And we're having a nice time on the holiday, and we were going to this a place called a milk bar, which, for those who aren't aware of what a milk bar is, they're basically a bit of a holdover from communist times there. They're basically a super cheap cafe that serves food, and they're famous for having awful customer service. There's a little square very near to where she grew up, where there's a table, which is one of these ones from an original milk bar in communist times, and the plate is fixed to the table, and there's a spoon chained to the plate. So you can't steal the cutlery or anything like that. And the food would literally just be slapped into the bowl on the table. You'd eat it, and then they'd sort of wipe out the remains for the next person to come in. So anyway, these milk bars are still sort of there as a legacy thing. They're a bit better than what they were now. But, you know, if you go to Poland, you've got to experience one of them. So off we are going to one of these milk bars for breakfast. And there's a tram system going through the city. And we're just sort of, we cross over near a tram, and the doors open, and some people come out. And this guy bumps into me, and he's like, he says something in Polish, like, oh, sorry, something. Then he looks at me. And he goes, oh, my God, are you Duncan Rhodes? And I was like, hello. And he's like, oh, my God, I just been. And he sort of like reaches around to, you know, his satchel, and he had a Necron codex. And he's like, I've just been reading this on the tram about my army. Oh, my God, I can't believe it's you. And I was like, oh, hello. What dynasty are you painting? You know, my girlfriend thought it was the funniest thing. She was rolling like around laughing on it and stuff. But we had a lovely little conversation. And I think I might have been more surprised than he was. But it's the strangest, most unexpected sort of, I say they're always unexpected, but like I never would have thought that to happen there. Like never, ever, ever. If I go to a gaming show, I imagine someone's going to want to say hello to me nowadays. But going on holiday in the middle of Poland? No. That was a very strange experience. I was thinking of it from his point of view. Can you imagine if you were there, sort of like, you know, there's a thing you're into, and then you walk outside and you bump into like the one of the personalities of the people who make that. Like, oh, it must have been the weirdest experience for him. Like, what are the odds? What are the odds? Incredible, really.
That's pretty cool. Well, yeah. We definitely want to thank you for your time. Please tell the listeners where they can go to find more information about you and your company and all the amazing stuff that you've got available for them.
Well, there's a few things. If you want to just take a look at what we do, you can go to I'm on Twitter, which my handle is @toothincoats. Hey, I can't believe no one had taken that. I can't believe when I changed, because I used to be Warmer TV Dunk. When I left, of course, it was running that across to take Warmer TV out there. I can't believe no one had taken Tooth and Coats. But anyway, so there's that. You can find me on Instagram at Duncan J. Rhodes, and that J stands for James, if you're interested. And on there, you see more of the kind of things that we're painting on the Academy, whereas Twitter is a bit more of like a casual chat, blog sort of thing. You can just sort of see what I'm painting, whereas on Instagram, we tend to be nicer, more complete things. And you're always welcome to tweet at me or talk to me. I try to drop in every few days to see what's going on. We have our YouTube channel, which is the Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy, or Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy. You can spot our logo. It's like these three colours with DR written on it. And on there, we put up three videos. We tend to put one up every 2 weeks or so, as best we can, so people can see what we're doing, and also so that you don't have to pay us to see stuff if you don't want to. Or you can go to the actual academy, which is duncanrhodes.com. And this is a subscription thing. It's £3.99 a month. And you can cancel any time, so you're not like beholden to a big cost or anything like that. But it's just like a reoccurring thing, and you'll see on there we update with new videos every week, usually on a Friday. Incidentally, I personally find it really weird that it's Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy and it's duncanrhodes.com. All right, that's very strange. It wasn't my idea. I wanted something like Tooth and Coat Studios or something like that. I don't know. But to name after me, because people think, oh, it's Duncan Rhodes rather than the Tooth and Coats guy, right? So it's a better way of finding us and understanding what we do. So that's why it's like that. I'm not wild about my name being used like that, but I totally see the purpose of it. So there you go. Those are the best places to find us. And you're welcome to contact us via the site. The email comes through to me and I'll do my best to reply to you. Or as I say, you can tweet at me if you want to. But I welcome anyone to talk to us about anything that we're doing. Any feedback, it's always welcome.
All right. Well, thank you so, so, so very much for your time. We wish you the best of luck. And thank you so very much for all the time and investment you put into the hobby, from where you start with Games Workshop to what you're doing now, especially with classes. That's actually how we met. And every single time, like, I've seen you do something online or heard about you, or even when we met you, it's just been such a really pleasant experience. And I am very grateful and thankful for just the amazing amount of work you've done to help kind of give people the opportunity to not be so mesmerized and intimidated by, oh, painting, like, it's kind of scary. Like, you've definitely helped bridge that gap. So it's not scary and you can do it. And I think giving that kind of hope to painters is just just so very precious and so very special. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for saying so as well. It's I'm glad you say that, because I mean, I'm super lucky to be in the position that I am in. Like really, really lucky. I'm always grateful to the people who follow what Roger and I are doing, because I mean, we're now making a living out of painting toys. You know, we're incredibly lucky and privileged to be in the position that we are. So we're not taking any of it for granted. That's why we want to give everything that we're doing our absolute best to make it as good as it can be, which is why we're so keen on hearing what people think about it. But I mean, when I was a kid, I was very shy and introvert and stuff. I still am an introvert, really, but I was super shy. So I can remember when I asked for the first time for some advice from a painter, and the response was really sort of condescending and patronizing to me, and it really put me off asking these sorts of things. I think it's easy to forget, especially when you get the hang of painting and you get good at it. It's easy to forget that everyone starts somewhere, and if you're not welcoming to new people, then new people aren't going to take into it. So I think it's a really important thing. So thank you for saying that. I'm glad you think so, because really that's kind of all I want to do, really, just help break down barriers for people and help them enjoy this hobby and be able to achieve the sort of miniatures and things that they can be really proud of, and ones that at least look like how they do on the box, you know, things that they can show off to people and feel proud about having done something.
All right. Well, once again, I want to say a big thank you to Duncan for coming on the show. It was truly a blessing and a gift to just be able to talk to him and query his brain and learn so many things from a gentleman who has been in this industry for a really long time and has been arguably the face of Games Workshop for many, many years on the hobby aspect and the YouTube side of things. So if you're interested in finding out more information about Duncan, like we said previously in the episode, you can check out DuncanRhodes.com or search/Google Duncan Rhodes Painting Academy. So that ends the show for this week. We are going to be putting out shows a little sporadically as we get different guests on to talk about the hobby and different aspects of Kill Team and Warhammer and Games Workshop in general. So I will keep you up to date on that via Discord and Facebook as those come along. But I really wanted to surprise the community with this, you know, pop out episode, because I know a lot of people are stuck at home. A lot of people are, you know, painting and spending time with their families. So I just wanted this to be kind of a fun surprise for the week and say, hey, Duncan Rhodes, have some fun. So thank you so much for listening. We will see everybody next time. And as always, remember, keep on killing them.